Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Monday, September 7th, 1998. In the fireside room this evening is John Schomburg. Session number is 98-1 and is titled A First-Person Account on Ministries to a Person on Death Row. Let's listen in.
John Schomburg, and I'm the pastor at Shepherd of the Hills Lutheran Church in Flagstaff, Arizona. Please don't ask me how hot it is. It is not a hot place. It's a cold place. 7,000 foot elevation. So we get 100 inches of snow, and everybody thinks that I live in that hot desert, but I don't. Been there for 13 years. The story takes place about from 1987 to 92. I'm going to share this in three stages. Two of them I know I can get through. I don't know about the third one. The first one is I'm going to introduce you to John Brewer and tell you how I got to know him. Second, I'm going to tell you about the days surrounding the execution of John Brewer. And then, if there's time, I'll answer your questions or comments that you want to make. This is not really a debate. I don't want to mix personal testimony with debate. That's not good. But tomorrow night there's going to be a debate, and then you can share it in a different sense, as I can in a different sense, a little bit less personal perhaps. I have notes here, and just so that I, I had to resurrect in my brain events that happened from 6 to 11 years ago. So I'm going to try to be as accurate as it can be, but some of it may be just borderline of that, but the intent is to be accurate. One morning, I got a call from John Brewer's mother. She lived in Pennsylvania, and she said, would I go to visit her son? He had committed a horrible crime. I don't believe that in that conversation she told me what it was. I'm not even quite remembering if I knew what it was until I went to see him. I said I would. And so I went down to the city jail, the county jail, where he was being held. When I went in, I had been in there at least a couple times before. And you come up to this booth, and across from the booth is a holding cell. And it's for people just coming in or for suicide people. And John had broken his glasses and tried to commit suicide, but only half-heartedly, because I couldn't even see a wound. That was my first visit with him, and my visits continued for at Flagstaff for a little over 2 years, and then down in Florence, about 200 miles away after that. Let me tell you about John, because I want you to to experience him as a person. And when we get into debate tomorrow, well, then you will have a person to have in your mind's eye, as I have. I'm going to tell you about John, warts and all, good and all, good and bad, that I experienced. He was, I think, 21 years of age when I met him. He was born in Pennsylvania, Western Pennsylvania, and according to him, throughout the 5 years that I knew him, we had a good debate going on if he knew who his father was. You know, there was a man that lived with the mother for a while, but he wasn't sure if that was his father, and so he kind of lived in that limbo. His mother just wouldn't tell him who his father was. So I don't know. I think at the end she told him, but I don't know that he really believed it. I think he knew his father eventually. He was a very old man compared to his mother, who was in her 40s or 50s. I mean, like 30 years older than the mother. That kind of oldness, anyway. His mother and his grandmother raised him until his grandmother died. And his mom, I met her on 4 or 5 occasions. And when he described her to me, it was pretty accurate what I saw and experienced. His mother, I forget her name, was a person who was very domineering to John. She was a person who was very overprotective. And so there was a funny kind of a relationship that I saw of fun little things that we remember doing together, going fishing and doing this. And then there was intense emotion, anger and hatred, at least on his part, toward her. I can tell you a couple stories about that. She was definitely not a nurturing woman. But you know, she was a woman who was abused sexually by her father in an era when that was not talked about. She was not a well person in many ways. And to be honest with you, when I was with her, I just didn't like being around that lady. I just have to tell you, she was not a very pleasant person. Very critical and complaining. He had a good church experience. That's how I got involved in the first place, is that on his own, not through anybody ever other effort, he walked down to the local Lutheran church, became a member, confirmed, acolyte. He enjoyed the role of helping the pastor. He had involvement not with children, not with youth, but with the pastor. And he felt some respect, I think, felt dignity at the church. He had good memories of the church. He is extremely traditional, and I'll tell you a story about that later. But he was raised in a very traditional Lutheran church, very high worship, and that was his experience, all on his own. As a child, John might have been called a nerd, meaning that he was the kind of guy that had four or five ink pens in his pocket and spectacles and a calculator hanging out of his pocket. He told me that he was graded as a genius. And sometimes I could see it, and sometimes, frankly, I couldn't. But that's what his IQ was reported at. He certainly was bright in the area of computers and math and a few things like that. But he was unable to make friends. He was a loner. And he was, I think, very teased and outcasted by the community. He was just different. And he didn't do a lot for himself, but he was also one who was very difficult for him to make friends. When you have heard these stories of these young, I think they've all been boys, who have gone into high schools and have shot people, that could have been John. He could have done his murder anywhere. Now, in this case, probably not for reasons, but he was that kind of a child who had been teased and extremely and not very well nurtured by anyone. He spent time in a psychological hospital as a child, 10 or 11, for I think up to 6 months. I think his diagnosis at that time, or maybe later, was brought out as borderline personality disorder, a severe disorder that can be treated these days, but maybe wasn't too treatable at that time, about 20 years ago, 15 years ago. High school, again, he was still a loner, but he did join a computer club, and he had a strong affection toward one particular computer that no longer is built. I can't remember the name of it. Kind of like a Commodore, but not that one. And it was a very positive, it seemed like a very positive experience. He was elected treasurer, and he had, again, respect and some honor in that group. So the only two places that I think, well, maybe the good one, the third one would be his girlfriend, but the two communities was the church, but not with children, and this computer club, and that would have been with fellow youth, at least four or five. Those are the things he talked about, mainly the computer club. John went to College, a Lutheran University college in Pennsylvania. He went there for one semester. And I was kind of surprised because of the overwhelming control and domination that his mother had on him, that he was able to get out of there for a semester. It was a real love-hate relationship. But he did go there for a semester, and he told me one time that he was in this his room, and he held up in his room from Friday till Monday, never went out, sobbing, crying, and no one came to see him. None of his classmates, his roommate, or anyone. Now, that may not be true. That's his memory of it, but he left shortly after. So he had some really good times, especially with one professor there that I conversed with, but I don't remember the professor's name. He went back to his mom. And it's very clear, a very important thing to notice, he went away, but he came back to his mother. He hated his mother in many ways, but he came back to her. Somebody here who's a psychologist maybe could explain that later, if anyone is. One day, about when he was eight, a formative thing happened, and I did not hear about this until a week or two or three, 4 weeks before his execution. And it was but formative. And I think the new Mickey Mouse Club was a new one, not the old one, was having auditions in his town. They were trying to come up with some actors or something. And he asked his mom, Mom, everybody's in the school is going down to audition, and he wanted to audition. And she said, no, they wouldn't come to a little town like this. They wouldn't do that. And he begged her and begged her and begged her to take him down, and she would not do that. And so it went, it came and went, and then she saw in the paper about it, and she said, oh, look, John, they had this thing about Mickey Mouse Club. Oh, it's too bad we didn't go. And from that moment on, in his unhealthy mind, he decided he would no longer trust his mother or love her at age eight. Now, I didn't hear this until later, but that turned out to be a formative decision in his life. So he was raised isolated from peers, unnurtured, very bright, but not really very savvy to the world. Not that kind of savvy. Immature, maybe a 12-year-old or 13-year-old in his mind. Many times I could see that. He had no trouble with the law. He had a clean sheet. He was a very obedient and lawful person. And that's one of the reasons why he went the route that he did in terms of not fighting his execution. He believed it was the lawful thing to do. And he was very rigid. And in one way, very ethical about it, because he believed in it before he committed the murder, and therefore he felt it would have been unethical for him to change. And so he had some of that. He met a girlfriend, I think her name was Rita, and Rita was a lot like John. She was also sexually abused. I can't say John was, I think he was, because his one sin that he did report to me was, and I feel comfortable telling you this, because he's wanted me to use whatever I can to help whomever I can in regard to this. So I do have a pretty good permission from him to share these stories. But he had some addiction to pornography for a while. I think when he found Rita, I think that left. So Rita came into his life. She was sexually abused. Two people hurting, unhealthy, needing to get away from family, clung together, whatever you'd say, and were together all the time. And it was a beautiful thing for them, talking as they'd never talked before, sharing and intense. And she's the one he murdered, so you have to understand that from his way of looking, he thoroughly and completely loved her more than anything in the world, anyone in the world, I should say. She moved into his room at his mother's house, got pregnant, and shortly after that, decided to go to Flagstaff, Arizona. She looked in some magazine and said it saw a picture and they rock climbed or something. She thought that might be fun, and so they went off on a 2,000-mile journey on that kind of basis. The mother was furious. She was total controller, but she wasn't able to succeed this time because he had an emotional relationship with someone else that was his out. And she did too. And so together, they kind of formed a union of one. And they went off. They weren't married. But she still won because she told him that if he did not call every night, that she would call the state police and claim that the car was stolen. And instead of him saying, "Mom, you're not going to do that. I'm not going to be controlled by you anymore," he called every night. Now you tell me which way that went, but that's it's a marvelous, incredible story there. So they went all the way across, him calling every night. They got to Flagstaff. I would have eventually have seen him at church, but he wasn't there that long. They found a roommate. They found a room in a very low. An income place, and a job at Arby's, both of them. And they were happy. They were going well. Looking forward to a baby, earning $4 an hour each, and that. And him calling his mother many, many times. Well, the next part of it, I'm not going to tell you everything, but I'm going to tell you enough to know that it was a horrible murder, okay? I'm not trying to sugarcoat this in any way. So if you don't want to hear it, you may leave. But I'll be prudent. He got a phone call from his mother, and apparently it was an extra hard one. And she told him that he had to come home. And he said he wouldn't come home, and probably slammed the phone down. Sat there, and the three of them sat, and the two women started talking about the phone call and started playing a little game of what if. Well, John, what would happen if Rita didn't stay around? What would happen if, what would you do if Rita left, or what would happen if Rita died? And then they started saying, well, John, you'd go home. You'd go back to your mommy. And he said, no, I wouldn't. And he said, yeah. And they essentially teased him. He didn't know what they were doing, and teasing is not a cause for death or murder, but that's what happened. And so they went to bed, the two of them went to bed together, and I don't know that he slept very well, and they woke up in the morning, the girlfriend left, and it was late, 8:30, and he probably had made his decision what to do. He calmly went over the door, locked it, and came over and said, and I don't remember exactly what, but he said something is, why ask if what I will do? Let's just find out, or something of that sort. He just kind of played into the game that they had been playing, and he had decided to kill her. Let me ask you this question. Where could he go that would best defend him and protect him from his mother?
To jail.
Yeah,
jail. Okay. Now, he knew that. Mm-hmm. He knew that. He knew what the state law was about execution. He knew a bunch of things, at least he reported to me that he did. And I think he had figured out that if he killed her, because he probably could guess that nobody was going to stay with him for that long. And he would have to go back to his mother. I think he really, really knew he would have to go back to his mother. And he did the one thing in his unhealthy mind that would save him and protect him from that. And he basically tried to strangle her and beat her. And it was a hard one because she fought back. And as she should have. And he was bigger and stronger than her, and he eventually won his battle with her. But it took a long time, to be honest. And it was very brutal. The pictures were very brutal. And when the judge had to make a decision about mitigating circumstances, the fact that he could have stopped, the fact that she fought, the fact she was pregnant, the fact that he committed sex with a corpse was all mitigating circumstances against John. Not talking about a healthy person here, but not talking about a person. I've seen many people like this. I mean, I've seen a lot of people like this, unhealthy people. And he snapped. His whole warped mind just snapped. He made an awful, horrible decision and carried it out. And so he took a shower, he called the police, sat there, and they came in, he put his hands out and said something about he wasn't going to fight execution or something like that. And was the perfect, humble, obedient inmate from that day on. The fact that he did this crime in the way he did it, if he had just used a gun, the state would not have had mitigating circumstances. But the way he did it, they had mitigating circumstances. But it was very brutal. And so sometimes he would talk to me and he would cry and he would feel so bad that the very person he loved was dead and he had done it. And other times, I never could figure this out after I'd heard that, he was glad that she was dead. I don't understand that, but I got those mixed messages all the time. So for 2 years, he stayed in Flagstaff, and I visited with him one to 1.5 hours nearly every week. And it was strange because I would go into there, and I never knew where I was going to meet with him. And the Flagstaff police or the sheriff or whoever runs that thing had a fairly lax procedure at that time because we were literally in rooms underneath cabinets and everything all by ourselves for all that time. Never was watched. I never was scared. I was big enough to handle myself, and he was not going to hurt me. That wasn't the issue. But it was an unusual feeling for me to actually experience this. So, but after a while, it wasn't. He became determined right after the murder to not fight execution, in fact, fight hard for execution. And this is very important to explain, and I'll explain it as I go along. But everything that he did was to be executed. And his lawyer that they appointed wanted to fight for, they always are designed to fight for people, and he just refused. He wrote letters and letters and letters and letters. I read them, and he was doing everything to be executed. The reason, there was an anti-capital punishment group, I think called the Capital Project. I'm positive about that at Tempe, at the law school. And so I got involved with them a little bit, and they fought to save his life. And he fought them tooth and nail. I mean, he liked talking to him because he needed somebody to talk to, but he fought him tooth and nail. He kind of became a celebrity. And this became a part of the ethos of it. The whole thing is his 15 minutes of fame. It wasn't like he was vain. He was actually humble in many ways. But he wanted to do this so much. And in talking with him, I will share with you that I am not for capital punishment before he did it and afterward he did it. But I talked my head off talking to him. I gave him theology, we talked practical, we talked law, we talked everything. And I never budged him on that, hardly at all. He respected me for it, he tolerated me more. And finally, I just said I have better ministry things to do with him than to do this. Maybe when he gets closer to the time, we can do it. So I kind of just stopped doing that. He was very self-centered. He was very self-focused on himself. When I was no longer needed or available to visit with him, we did send letters back and forth. I did visit him in Florence, but not nearly as often. Nearly as often. It wasn't important. And then when the time came, then I became important again. So there was that, and I knew that. He manipulated lots of people, including me. But I accepted that for the what I hope was the greater good. He was likable. He was very mature, obedient in many ways, very wounded and conflicted, and hated his mother with a passion in many ways, and loved her in many ways, whatever he meant by love. Let me tell you one story, and then we'll move quickly to the next phase. About a month before he was executed, he had to come up for some hearing. I don't know what. I don't remember what. And his mother flew out. She was a very poor lady, and so she was always coming out at the expense of this capital project, which was good. And she pleaded with me to see him. She had not seen him for 3 years. And I thought that was very important. And when she meant seeing, she meant to be in the same room with him and not through a glass. So I talked with him, and he was reluctant and reluctant. Finally said, okay. So we sat, the three of us, with guards in this room, and she sat at one end of the table, about as far away as you are, and he sat here. And I sat there, and the guards were all around, and he was locked up. And they started pitter-pattering, as I've seen him do, this stuff that was their style of talk about some old stuff. And then John, I pleaded with him just to be nice, just to be kind, just to give her one moment of life, of good memory. I just pleaded with him to do that before. But he could not do that. And he said something. And then she said something. And pretty soon it was a vicious thing going. I looked at the guards, and we stopped it right then. It was just out of hand. He was just about ready to get up and try to get up, I should say, and do something. He couldn't, but he tried. The other thing I wanted to tell you, I'm not sure, really not sure what the effect of this is, but he was into heavy, into Dungeons and Dragons. I don't say that in some way. I say it because I think he was into mind stuff, and he was always into mind stuff. He never was into heart stuff, and he played games. And I think in this Dungeon and Dragon, I don't know, maybe you kill people or you kill things. I don't know, but he claimed very much that it had no effect on him. But I don't know. I touched John for 2 years. I hugged him, gave him communion, of course. We sat, you know, just sat. When he cried, I could put my hand on his leg or whatever. There was a lot of good human touch. And I'll tell you that I came to love John Brewer as not a member of my church, he never joined, but as a member of my parish. When he left to go to Florence for 3 years, no human being ever touched him in a loving way. I'm sure they touched him in a physical way to do something with him. But nobody ever put a hand on his shoulder or anything. He received no human touch for 3 years. Most of the people there don't receive it. If he was in isolation, not because that's where you put him when they've on death row, it's because he wrote a letter into the prison, and he's told the prisoners to stop being babies. They did what they did, and they should be paid the punishment for it, and they shouldn't have their TVs and stuff. And he had a death threat against him, and it was a real one. I went, oh gosh, John. Yeah. And so now he was in isolation, and it was funny, he was so afraid of being stabbed that he wouldn't even go outside. You know, he had an hour. So he was afraid of death, and he was wanting death. Okay. So, at the end of 5 years, the sentence was coming close, and In normal, it would take 10 to 15 years to execute a person in Arizona. But if you don't fight it, in fact, if you fight against it, well, you now know how long it takes, 5 years. So I went down to visit him, and it's really an awesome experience to go into this high security system and be locked. And it still is terrifying to do that, even in the city prisons. But in the federal prison, the state prison, it was really awful to be in there. And I was just in there for an hour or two. So let's go quickly to the next part here. The last days. He was successfully fighting his things. People were fighting for him, for his commuting, but he was going the opposite direction. And so it came down. I went down 2 weeks before the execution, and there was a breakthrough. I have no idea what the breakthrough was or why, but he told me, he said he thought he would fight the execution. Oh, was I excited. I really felt like, well, you know, the waiting was worth it. And I told him that, and I said that you know, because they don't usually execute people who have crimes of passion. They don't usually do that. They execute people who have a different kind of motive, but not that one. And they usually put them in jail for a long time, about 25 or 30 years. But there's a lot of people walking on the streets that are out after that. And he didn't know what he was going to do if that ever happened. So I went to Tempe and visited with the people immediately afterwards, driving to there. Said, get down there immediately. Well, he did, but he had changed his mind. And so I never saw that again. I went back another time just a few days before, and then the last trip was on the day of the execution, or the day before, actually. I met with, at noon, I met with Al Chaplin, a Lutheran pastor, and his supervisor, the head chaplain, a black man, who's the head chaplain. And they told me that all the rules, and I would not be able to touch him, that they would give him communion, I would be there, a few things like that. They didn't like the rules, but that was the rules. They told me a few other things, and they were really ready for it to help me all along. They knew the impact on me. And so Al Becker is the name. He was very faithful to his calling to help me. And so we moved. The first thing we did, we went over to another building, and we had the final hearing of the parole board, a five-person parole board. And the Capitol people talked, and the Quaker always comes and talks. The Quaker person always comes and talks. And then a psychologist from Florida flew in and said from the reports that he had read, John was a borderline personality disorder, but if they gave him just a few months, he would diagnose and tell you and maybe give him some medicine so that some Prozac or whatever it was going to be. I think it was Prozac, actually. To give him the opportunity to be able to speak with clarity of mind instead of being under this thing that he was. And he would do that. He felt that John, he had several other things, but he was severely borderline personality disorder. And he said, this is what they do. This is how they act. These five people are lay people. I think they aren't. I don't think they're paid to do their job. I spoke. And I had a really horrible problem because I wanted very much to tell them everything I knew, but some of it was so confidential and it was so opposite of my relationship with John in terms of what he wanted. I told the gospel, I told my opinion and thoughts, and I told him that I believed that he had repented of his sin, of his crime. But I don't know if I did right or wrong in there. I mean, I don't know right or wrong, but if I did what was the best. But because I was caught between that attitude that I had and his attitude. And you can tell me what you think later. Anyway, But I did try to bring the gospel into it, and at least let the gospel speak its word as beautifully as I could. Then, but no matter what I said, no matter what anyone else said, John had to speak. Of course, the defense spoke too, and they pretty much said, you know, it was a heinous crime and deserved execution. And he got up. He was in a cage over here somewhere, and he spoke. And he just basically taunted them and said they'd better kill him, better execute him, because they would be not doing their job and a whole bunch of other things. And basically said he was glad he did it. I don't think he was glad he did it, but that's what he said. And how was I going to refute that? But I didn't believe that he really meant that. This was his 15 minutes of celebrity, and he was orchestrating it all. There is no way that he would have been executed if he had said, no, I don't want to be executed. The state attorney general Woods said to me, or at least to me through somebody, that said, if John says, stop it, I will stop it. I will stop it, and we'll start from square one. Because they don't do that. They don't do that. I mean, they don't execute that kind of person on a regular basis. As far as I understand. And he was ready to stop it. I mean, he's in favor of it, but executions, but I mean, he is Attorney General of the state of Arizona, so I guess he probably better be. So he manipulated it all. I mean, he manipulated the state of Arizona into killing him, because he could not kill himself. After that, I went to see him one more time, try to talk with him. No, it wasn't going to work, and I just let it go. I figured I needed to be there for whatever he wanted, not for what I wanted. And so we just chatted. Whatever he wanted to talk about, we talked about old times, good times, things. He was remarkably pretty much at ease, a little hyper, as you would expect. He ordered his last meal, and it was his special meal, and he had thought of it for 5 years, so he knew what he wanted, and he got it. What it was a room about this size, and there were two cages. It was a cage, a little toilet inside the cage, and you could circle all the way around the cage. And the guard room was over here, and right over here was the gas chamber. And when he was gone, I didn't want to do it while he was there, but when he was gone, I was just sitting there, I said, could I go in? He said, yeah, the guards are going in. So I walked around. I didn't sit in it. I didn't want to get trapped in there. But it was a horrible feeling being in that gas chamber, knowing how many people had died there before. But he wasn't going to die in there. Two more things. We were going to give him communion. The three of us, the three chaplains, there were two chaplains and me. And they opened the door. The two chaplains walked in, and I walked in, and nobody stopped me. The chaplains, bless their soul, just knew, wow, this is interesting, and the guards didn't know the rule. The warden had told me, but the warden had not told them that I was not supposed to touch him. And the chaplains knew it, and God bless their soul, it was just like a spirit stopped it. And it was just, honest to God, I felt like a spirit stopped that thing. So we went in there, we talked, confession, the whole works, and the strangest thing happened in there was that John, as I said, was a very literalist, a very a traditionalist, and he wanted us to read it according to the red book. He didn't know anything about the green book. He wanted the red book. Well, we couldn't find a red book. So we said, John, can't find a red book. Well, go from memory. Well, we tried to go from memory. The chaplain actually was doing that. And he stopped him in the middle of saying something, said, no, don't say it like that, say it like this. And he would say it like it was. And we just looked and the King James Version, everything. And finally he said, John, we're just doing the best, okay. Then he calmed down. And so we gave communion, and he wanted it into his mouth. He orchestrated the communion. He orchestrated us all over the world. And then he got up at the end, and he hugged the other two, and he gave me a bear hug that was as tight as one can give. And I knew that if I looked at those guards, that that they would have been in there in an instant. And the chaplain said, I don't know why they weren't in there. Nobody does that. And it was okay with me. I didn't bother me. He was very hyper at that time. So then the time came that we had to leave. And we said our goodbyes. But I said, John, I don't want to see you die. I don't want that in my memory. But I want to be what's best for you. And so he knew that. He knew that I was had talking about that before. And he had two boyfriends there, two friends. They did come all the way from that room. I don't remember if they saw him or not. I think they did. And maybe not. I just don't remember. So we had agreed that what we would do, well, I'll tell you what we did, but in a few minutes. So we went to the chapel, and we waited for about an hour. They had to get him ready and everything, and there was a lot of press. Because he was a celebrity. He was really a second man executed by lethal injection. And so the attorney general came in and talked to us a little bit and told us what went on. The reprieves were none. So we knew the execution was going to take place. So at 12 o'clock or thereabouts, the attorney general came with us and escorted us down. And the men and women who had, I think all men, who had come to witness, there's always about 20 witnesses, and they mostly media people. They were in a darkened room that was not more than 8 foot or 10 foot deep and about 25 foot wide. And they were politely and quietly behind us. And we came in, and there was a window, and we couldn't see anything through the window. And I had my collar on, the two boys, and young men. And then the curtain came open, and there was John. And he was laying on a gurney, and you could see that he had some equipment into his arm stuff. And he looked at me, and he mouthed something, and he gave me a thumbs up, and I think he said, I love you. And he said it to the other three, too. And we couldn't talk to him, and there was some man in there that was going to, he or somebody was going to push the buttons. And in about 2-3 minutes, the attorney general said, it's time to leave, so we left. And before we even got back to the chapel, the medicine was pushed into it. What it was a first thing is to put him to sleep, and then the second one is to kill him. And I guess it went okay. I mean, in terms of the procedure was done. Before we even got back there, he was dead. The people went out, and Al talked with me a little bit. And then I got in my car. I mean, it's kind of odd. I got in my car, and I drove to the home that I was staying at. I went to a Circle K to get it was hot. I was hot. Got a coat, and there were the guards there, and they saw me, and I saw them, and we didn't say anything to each other. But they were talking a little bit about, you know, this was overtime for them. This was an event. I don't know what they felt about it, but they weren't that close to it. So there was a candlelight vigil also for it. So I went to visit the sleep overnight with a pastor friend. The next morning, of course, he was very nice and talked to me. And the next morning, he said, you've been invited to the Arizona Ecumenical Council meeting that just happened to be meeting in Casa Grande. They would like you to talk if you feel like it. And I said, yeah, we'd like to do that. And so immediately after this experience, brothers and sisters of the faith, who were very sympathetic to my to that cause and for my role in it, but for capital punishment against them, I spoke to them, and they were very good. It was just the way that the Lord had wanted it, I suppose. I spoke to other people since then, and you're my first group that I've talked with since 5 years ago. One of the things that I want to close with is that the thing that we all struggle with in terms of capital punishment is the victims and the victim's family, and Rita's mom and dad and her brothers and sisters. And felt a great deal of pain for them throughout this crisis and problem area in this 5 years. And I never talked with them. I didn't do that. They were back in Pennsylvania. But what I have learned is that the only way to let go of something is to forgive. And retribution just doesn't do it. Now, they might have thought that, but if I had been their pastor, I would have tried to guide it along that path, that they just had to let go of it and forgive. Because holding it in an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth and revenge just ain't the way that they heal, whether they like it. I mean, that's just the truth as far as I see it. They may see it differently, but I see it. I don't know if the title, How to Work with People Who Committed Horrible Crimes, I have only done it a couple times. I have been involved with one other murder of a member of my church. And that was another story, but I just try to love the man. And his crime was horrible, and he knew it was horrible. I didn't have to point that out to him. I just pastored him as best I could. And my members were very good. Not every one of them would have been philosophically in my shoes, but every one of them supported me with prayers and
both before and after.
Well, that's about all I want to say right now, other than your questions or comments. Yeah.
How has this affected you long term?
Well, along with two or three other things that have happened right along with this ministry with another couple people and long-term counseling, people who are very wounded and conflicted. It's maybe very sensitive to wounded and conflicted people. And I will boldly say this, not trying to worry about whether it's humble or not, I suppose, is that I'm a far better pastor and far better counselor to people. Because I take them where they're at. I take people where they're at. The other thing is that every time I see someone, and of course I'm imperfect in this, so don't hold me to everything, but I try to realize that the woundedness came about for the same reason that the state of Washington is green. I mean, it rains a lot here, you know, and that's why it's green. Well, the same way with wounded people and why they act crazy is they were wounded. And so I did not like his mother at that moment, but I do have sympathy for her because she was a wounded woman too. And
do you think that you have more ability to sense a wounded person before they get into trouble?
Well, I don't know about, I think I have a greater sensitivity to reading people, but I'm careful about that since I can also read them wrong. But I try to, I can read people. I can read it. I don't know what to do with it always. It has made me more of what Henry Nouwen calls a wounded healer, because it's shortly after that that we started our healing ministry at the church, which I will talk about on Monday or Thursday. It all goes together. It all goes together.
Why didn't they allow you to hug him, or didn't want you to hug him at that moment?
Because the danger of...
You might have killed him, is that?
Oh, no. The danger, he could have harmed me and the state, and I wasn't bound to let that happen. And I don't think any other pastor has done that since. I think that was the Holy Spirit. I think he came in and shut those people's heads off, and they didn't know what to do.
That's about jailers in Scripture.
Yes, I know that backstory.
Did you ever learn anything more from the earlier hospitalization that he had, or did you try and seek any more information about his childhood, because I think that's the kind of thing that we want to get as much information as we can to find out how to prevent this kind of problem.
I knew about his childhood hospitalization a little bit, but I did not know what the doctor told me that very day of the execution. I did not have that information. I did not know that he was even officially declared a borderline personality, which I have studied since then because of the guy's book that I ordered. And I don't think, I would not want John on the streets. I would, and I wouldn't want most murderers on the streets either, though maybe, you know, there's some that get out. That's not the issue for me. Mm-hmm. It is simply, and I don't want to get into that issue, I just want to say that, that John should, he was really unhealthy, but locking him up in a cell is, it made him let, you know, continue. Actually, in some ways, he probably blossomed there because it was very controlled and it kept him from his mother.
Do you think that his life could have been made different if his mother had gotten medical help?
At what point? Yes, absolutely. If she had become healthier during his formative years, he would have been a healthier person. Absolutely. If she got it later, I don't know. But
at any point, did you tell her that she needed medical help?
I don't believe I did. I only saw her about 3 times. And she was a powerful woman. She scared the heck out of me, to be honest.
How did you steel yourself emotionally in this particular? Because it sounds like it was an extremely unusual, different experience for you.
Well, some of the normal ways pastors do that would be with prayer and with the support of the community. I myself, I believe I'm very healthy emotionally and well. And so when he attacked me or something because I didn't play the game right, or he did a couple times, I just told him what I thought, and he immediately backed down. So I was just myself. But I can't say, I'm not really I don't think of myself as a heavy emotional person, so I guess I did what everybody else does. You mask it and you put it into places. But, and I feel tense right now about sharing this with you, and so it's emotional to me. But my brothers and sisters in this room, even though they have different opinions on capital punishment, I know that you are, you know, for my part of the story, you know, are with me, you know, I know that. But, and I knew that for my people. It wasn't about me, it was about him, and I remember that. Yes, yes.
I think probably one of the most healing things for you was the opportunity that the Lord gave to you to speak to this group, because you had to talk about it, and it was right immediately following.
Yeah, immediately.
Yes,
it was. It was awesome, because I wouldn't have stayed another day or two.
Yeah.
Yes, ma'am. Yeah.
Did he have any siblings?
No.
Okay.
Only child. Yes.
John did, hypothetical, of course, but did he express any wish that, or have any, would the outcome have been different relative to his desire for execution been different had something happened to his mother in the meantime, or did he ever express regret that he hadn't killed his mother as opposed to his girlfriend?
No, he never said, she would have been the next target if he was in a rage, probably, but maybe not. I'm not sure about that, but if she had died earlier, he was very, he had a real commitment to law and order, honest, he really did, and so he really believed people should be executed for that crime, and he did not back away, but one time, all 5 years on that issue, he really believed it. I mean, with his whole heart.
That's also a classic symptom of borderline personality at a certain stage.
Yeah.
The that they're very kind of fundamentalistic.
Yeah.
Black and white, right and wrong. I did what was wrong. I need to be punished. It's just heartbreaking to me that the diagnosis comes late, that the, you know, that makes me wonder how many other people really need medical psychiatric treatment instead of.
He received a psychological examination, and the guy named Bayless came and spoke at his at the place when he pleaded guilty, and then the judge. And I gave my talk to the judge that day. That was 2 years afterwards, and Bayless came up, and I had to go to Phoenix for a meeting, and I left absolutely convinced that he was going to be sentenced to life imprisonment, and I was shocked. Like 3 or 4 hours later, the judge did that. The judge isn't any horrible man or anything. He's a good judge, but when your criminal does what he did the same thing he did later. He was up for re-election. There are a lot of things. One of the lawyers made a technical error. I don't remember what it was, but it allowed for this thing to continue. This report about his borderline, I never heard about that. Mm-hmm. And I don't think Bayless heard about it either. He had to come up with his own stuff. Mm-hmm. But the psychologist said this man is sick. He shouldn't be executed.
John, did John ever talk about suicide or threatened suicide?
John was a wuss. A wuss. That's what the kids say today. That means that he was afraid of pain, and he didn't want to kill. He didn't want to kill himself because he was hurt, and he didn't want to kill himself because that's not the way it's done. The way it's done is execution, and he did not want to break the rules.
Did he ever identify with his unborn child? Did he ever have any future thought?
Well,
could he extend that?
He had. He reported different things. Sometimes he was very hateful to his girlfriend in the sense of it made more sense why he murdered her if he hated her. But then he told many wonderful stories, and the child was another thing. He felt that was another reason why he should be executed, is he killed a second child person.
Was he repentant?
Well, yeah, I think he was repentant to me and as me as pastor was repentant, and he believed that God had forgiven him. It wasn't a question of God's forgiveness; it was a question of his own forgiveness, and it was a question of. Oh, I got to tell you that during the hearing, five people were there, and one of them was an LDS person. A male person, and the vote was 3-2. Oh man, my heart sunk when it was 3-2. And this LDS person said, "Well, you know, the Bible tells us an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, and therefore I vote for execution." Well, that was exactly what John told me on a number of occasions, and you know, I tried to convey the gospel, so he just didn't hear it. And so he was an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. And after a while, I almost said, "John, I believe you. I mean, it's the only way that you think you're going to do this." He wasn't gospel, and he was very legalistic, mm-hmm. very law and order. I'd be happy to share anytime with you one-to-one, and then tomorrow night, I'm not going to be leading the forum, but I can offer you a few other reasons. One last comment. I wrote a letter in the Phoenix paper, and I said, I said that I believe there were many victims. Certainly Rita was a victim, and certainly the family was victims. But when I looked at the eyes of those five people having to make a decision to say yes or no, and I knew what I experienced, and I knew what that jailer experienced, I knew what the person who pushed the button experienced, I said I felt there were many victims. And there was a good Lutheran folk from some place in Phoenix that wrote a letter back in the paper and said, "Oh, that's hogwash." And, well, anyway, that's the last letter I wrote. But anyway. That's a good question for tomorrow's debate, or who are the victims? Thank you very much. I appreciate it.